That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Welcome to That's What She Said, conversations with interesting people from the world of sports, music, comedy, and more, talking about their lives, careers, successes, and failures. Latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Today's guest, Shay Serrano from The Ringer and other outlets. Love this conversation. He's somebody that just kept being around me and around my circles, and we would end up being tagged in the same tweets, or people would say that I should go look at what he had done for some charity. And so I decided I needed to get to know him a little better, and I'm so glad I had him on. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Shay Serrano.
That's What She Said.
Somebody on Twitter made fun of me for saying every single week on the podcast, I'm really excited for my guest. And the thing is, I wouldn't have anyone on that I wasn't excited for. So, Twitter person, thank you for acknowledging that I repeat myself often. And instead, I'm going to say I'm enthused for my next guest, because it's a different word, but it means the same thing. And it's Shay Serrano. He writes for The Ringer. He's also written for Grantland, GQ, ESPN, LA Weekly, Rolling Stone, MTV, Vice. He's the author of two New York Times bestsellers, The Wrap Yearbook and Basketball and Other Things. And I was just telling him before we hit record that I was very Shay Serrano adjacent. And after enough people messaged me on Twitter and would at him about everything from charitable giving to the WNBA to other things, I realized that I needed to get to know this guy a little better. So thanks for making some time, Shay. I'm excited to try to get all of the many questions I have into this very short 45 minutes. We'll see if we can pull it off.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah, I want to start at the beginning. So you're a San Antonio guy. When you were a kid, what were you into? What did you think you were going to grow up and do?
When I was a kid, I thought I was going to be the starting point guard for the Spurs is what I thought I was going to be. And then, like, in 10th grade, I stopped growing. And I was like, well, this is clearly not going to work out. So then, yeah, I was just trying to find other things. You know, there was a bit where I thought I was going to be in the FBI because I had read, like, a criminal profiling book that I thought was cool. And then CSI, the TV show, came out. And I was like, yo, I want to do that. I want to wear sunglasses and take them off and say things. So I went to college, and, like, I went to this school called Sam Houston State, which is a criminal justice, like, that's their thing that they do. And I started taking criminal justice classes. I was really into it. And then one year, maybe like my second year there, I took a class where they showed us actual pictures of a crime scene. I remember the teacher was walking around, or the professor, and she was dropping like manila folders onto everybody's desk. And then she told us to open them, and I opened them, and it was like pictures of dead bodies. And I was like, oh, no, this is not for me either. Oof. So that's what I thought I was going to be. I thought it was going to be a bunch of stuff that I ended up not being.
Had you not considered the dead body part of the criminal investigating before the actual photos?
It looks so much different on TV than it does in a picture. I can't even imagine what it looks like in real life, but in a picture of real life, it's horrifying.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I knew way before you that would never work out for me based on not being able to kill ants without feeling bad. So I don't think that would be the right spot for me. All right. So you graduate Sam Houston State. Did you graduate, and did you get a degree in something?
I got a degree in psychology.
Okay.
Maybe like, you know, after I saw those dead body classes, I went to talk to my guidance counselor and told her, like, yo, this is not for me. Let's figure something else out. And we were talking about what parts of that job I thought were interesting. And then we ended up like, oh, you know what? You could probably, why don't you be like a counselor of some sort? I said, all right. I'll be a guidance counselor at a middle school, but I'm going to start out as a teacher, and I'm going to coach basketball and do all this junk. And so I got my degree in psychology with the intention of going to graduate school later to get a master's so I could be a counselor. But by the end of college, again, I knew, like, this is not a place I need to be. I'm not built for this world, so I just started working.
Yes, yeah, so you went into construction right after college. Was that just the job that you could find that paid money?
Yeah, my at the time, my girlfriend, now my wife, her brother-in-law was working at a construction company, and they needed people, and so he got me on there. And it was like a $30,000 a year type job where you just are on construction sites sort of fixing things and or scheduling stuff to get fixed. And I did that for like 2 years, and it was super sucky.
Yeah. It's manual labor is tough, man.
It's the worst.
And hot and yeah. You're doing construction, and is the back of your mind still that you in some way want to be involved in working in a school, or was that, all right, I got to put my degree to some use and I'm sick of doing construction. So middle school science it is.
Oh, no. I knew I wanted to be a teacher when I left Sam Houston, but since I didn't get a degree in education, I knew I was going to have to take like a certification course. And I also knew I had this job available. Like, we're graduating on a Saturday. I could start working on Monday.
Right.
And, like, I could have money, and I could send money to my people in San Antonio. And so I did. That's why I started that job. And then, you know, you blink, and it's 2 years later, and you realize, like, this ain't it again. So by that time, my wife was teaching, and I just took the same course, the emergency certification course that she took, which was, like, you go for 6 weeks after work a few times a week, and then once on Saturday, and you take a test, and then now you can be a teacher.
So who are your people in San Antonio that you were sending money to?
I'll talk about, like, my mom, my dad, and, you know, my immediate family.
What were they doing?
My mom was working at a gas station. She still works there. This year will be her 30th year, which is fucking nuts.
Yeah,
and my dad drives a bus for the city, which he's also done for a little over 30 years now.
That's crazy. That's to have jobs for that long. So, all right. So you take the certification, you end up working as a middle school science teacher for 9 years, which is crazy because that is a little bit longer than the time that I've been working for ESPN, which feels like a very long time and very much a career. Right? That this is what I do. When you were doing that, was there any part of you that saw beyond teaching, or did you think, I'm going to be one of those teachers that starts out as the young, cool guy and ends up as the, oh my God, Professor Serrano's been here for 40 years?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to be. That was the first time I had a job. I'm talking about teaching here. It was the first time I had a job where it felt right. All the pieces felt right. And I knew after the first year that I wasn't going to be a counselor. I wanted to stay in the classroom. I knew after the second year that I was going to be doing it at the school where I was for a long time. And then I knew after the third year, like, okay, this will be my life. I'm going to be the teacher who 1 year I have some kids and I'm taking role and I recognize their names. And I'm like, oh, I taught your mom and your dad. Like, that was a job that I wanted for sure.
That's crazy. So what year did you graduate Sam Houston?
I graduated Sam Houston in 2004, I think.
So you met your wife your freshman year of college.
Yeah, I met her the second semester. She showed up that second semester, so I think I finally ran into her March or something like that.
And then how long were you dating before you got married?
Oh, shoot. We dated for 7 years before we got married.
So you're a couple years into your teaching. She's teaching mm-hmm. as well. And I need to hear about you being married in a hospital.
Oh, okay, so what happens is we know we're going to get married. We've talked about it several times, but I was like, in my head,
we talked about it several times. Does that mean you had bought a ring and proposed, or you guys were just having casual, like, yeah, I think you're my person, and, like, let's get married sometime?
Yeah, that part.
Okay, so no, we're like, down okay, on well, one knee yet.
No, not yet. We're going to eventually get married, but I was doing the thing where when you're 20 and you think, like, okay, I need to have everything figured out first.
Totally.
So I'm like, I can't take care of you. I can't provide for
and
you.
40 and 50.
Yeah,
it doesn't
yeah.
matter what okay. age you are. You got to feel like everything's all together. Yeah.
So we were talking about that for a bit. And again, we're together 7 years. We're like, all right, cool. Let's get married. I proposed. We started planning the wedding and she gets pregnant. And, we find out that it's twins. And so we're like, all right, cool. You know, we're just sort of plotting around it. She's handling all of everything like she always does. She's planning the wedding. She's working full time. She's doing all this stuff. And one day she's pregnant for like 4 months now. She's at work and she goes into labor, which is like, that's a bad time to go into labor is 4 months. And so they like rush her to the hospital. It's this whole big thing. They do the surgery and they put her on bed rest. And this is legit the day before or 2 days before our actual wedding was supposed to happen. And they tell her, like, you can't do the wedding. You can't get up. If you walk around, the babies are going to come out. Like, it's not time. So we were like, our people are flying in or driving in. Everybody's showing up for the wedding, and we have to tell them, like, hey, this thing got canceled. We've got this stuff going on. But my uncle is a pastor at a Catholic church in El Paso, and he had showed up. He was going to do a service. And since he was there anyway, I was like, well, I still would like to get married. Do you want to get married? She said, yeah, let's do it. So we had it. We just did a wedding in the hospital room. There was maybe like 15 or 20 people that came, and the pastor showed up, and she didn't have a wedding dress. She was wearing a wedding gown. A hospital gown.
So I just put, it's a gown.
Yeah. So I put one of those on too, and we like did the ceremony, and there you go. That's the wedding story.
That's sort of oddly romantic, you both in hospital gowns. Do you look back and think to yourselves, oh, that's quirky and a great memory of we loved each other and it wasn't about the marriage? Or is there this, this we got to do this again and do it differently?
There's two parts of that. Number one is definitely, I look at it as a thing where, like, that's how much we love each other. Is we just knew we wanted to be together, so whatever, we'll just do it how we can do it. But also, in my heart, I know she deserves that moment of wearing the dress and walking down the aisle and everybody looking at her. Like, I do feel bad about that we've not had that. She's not had that chance yet. Maybe eventually.
Yeah, for sure. It's fun. The party's fun. My husband and I basically just got married so we could have a party because we were together for so long. We're like, we don't really need to be married, but we do want to throw a kick-ass party with a bigger budget than your average Christmas party. You end up with three sons, and did you have all three of your sons when you were still teaching, or was some of that when you were starting to get into the writing side of things?
No, I was teaching the whole time. The boys showed up the end of my first year during the second year of teaching. That was the twins. The smaller one showed up a few years later, 2012. So I was still teaching, yeah.
So then, but I read that in 2007, that was when you first did a little bit of freelancing, mainly because your wife was on bed rest, and so you just wanted some extra income as she was out of her teaching gig. And so is that really when you started to at least freelance, start writing?
Yeah, I started freelancing, I think it was end of 2007, maybe early 2008. I mean, we're far enough away where that's all starting to get kind of hazy.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it was after the boys were born, so it was definitely after 2007. And she was on bed rest, and the plan was she was going to have the babies and then stay home for 6 months and then go back to work. And so we were like, whatever, running out of money during that time because she didn't make it the whole 9 months that she had to stop working at 4 months of pregnancy. So we didn't have that. And I couldn't get a job at like Target or Papa Doe as a waiter or whatever, because whenever I'd go apply, they would tell me I already had a full-time job, so they weren't going to hire me. So I just needed a thing I could do on my own. And I was legit Googling work from home jobs, and writer was one of them. So I was like, well, I'll just do that. I'll just be a writer. And I started calling newspapers and emailing people and trying to get someone to let me write for them.
So when you were at Sam Houston, when you were growing up, at any point in your sort of academic life, was writing something that you had taken a particular shine to? Did you like it, or were you good at it?
No, I was terrible at it, and I didn't like it. And they don't tell Mexican kids on the south side of San Antonio that that's a job you can have. You don't know that that job exists. You're like going to work at the tire shop, or you're going to paint houses or do the yard work. Like, that's it. And so I didn't know anything about it. And that was legit the first time I'd ever considered it, was when I read You Can Do This from Home. So I didn't know anything about it. The only thing I knew was I was good at talking to people, so I figured I could talk my way into it eventually, and that's exactly what happened.
That's crazy. I mean, first of all, absolutely. Sports writing and working in this industry in general requires a great deal of BSing. Like, that might be the most important quality, is for you to be able to talk your way into and out of things and be a good hustler. But writing itself is tedious and very specific at times, but it's clear that from the beginning you were writing with your own style, right? You were writing about hip hop mostly when you started out. So something that you were passionate about, and that makes a huge difference. But how do you convince the Houston Press or LA Weekly or anywhere else to take pieces? Were you doing full-fledged pitches with content, or were you trying to get advances after you just pitched just a concept?
Well, the first place I wrote for was this little tiny, it was a legit neighborhood newsletter that this woman and her husband were printing up in her garage. And I found it at a, there's a pizza place by our house, and they had a kiosk with a bunch of little tiny, like, local papers. And I just grabbed one of all of those and started contacting everybody. And so when I got in contact with her, I was like, hey, can I write about this or that? And she just let, you know, she didn't have anybody else who was writing for her. It was her and her husband. So she said, all right, I'll give you $15. We need an article about the Texans. Can you write that?
Right.
And I was like, oh, sure. Yeah, no problem. And then after I wrote that, I wrote another one about baseball, about the Astros. And I took those two pieces to the Houston Press. And I was like, look, I'm an actual writer. I have published stuff. And then I got a co-sign from a guy that I'd interviewed. And he was friends with the editor there. And so they brought me on. And that's really all it is. Like, once you get, if you crack the door open a little bit, I'm going to slide through.
Absolutely.
And that's what I did at the press. And then I started writing at the press. And then I would go to the, bigger places. And, LA Weekly, look, I'm a real writer. I've got places here at the press. And then I get at LA Weekly and I go to the next place, like MTV, ESPN. Look, I'm a real writer. I've got pieces here. You just keep on flipping them bigger and bigger as you go.
So there's this thing called imposter syndrome, and they used to think that it affected primarily women, but they now realize it affects everyone. It's just that societal expectations for women exacerbate the issue. And the idea of imposter syndrome is essentially that you are constantly worried you're going to get figured out. And Nobel Prize winning authors and the highest level of people will admit that the next book that comes out is the one that they think finally people are going to realize that they're not that good. And so often that's what trips people up as they're trying to get started, is either the expectation that if you're not perfect, you don't deserve it, or that you're not even good enough to be given a shot. It sounds to me like that has never been an issue for you. Like, you were showing up at places, and whether or not you were technically qualified, you were going to tell them that you were and that you deserved a chance.
Yeah, I do feel that. I felt that later, which is crazy. I didn't feel it in the beginning. I think maybe I was just a little too dumb to realize what was at stake. So I was
that usually require a degree in this or.
Yeah, exactly. But then once I got, a little bit bigger, my name started to ring out a bit. And I knew people were like looking at me for things or about things. And I do, you do start to feel that way for sure.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it's why sometimes the best voices or most unique voices don't make it to be heard, because they feel like they have to get through this like ringer, no pun intended, of of established voices who decide whether or not their content or their voice is worthy. It's funny to me that the story that got you noticed by another writer at Grantland and got you your first, your big full-time Grantland gig was a story about having sex with your wife to Drake. And I read it, and it's good. It's funny. And there's so much freedom in writing for places like the LA Weekly because you can kind of say whatever. What was that like for you to be writing for, LA Weekly is a big publication as well, but to have it noticed and have that lead to something bigger?
That was a cool feeling. My editor there is this guy named Ben Westhoff, who I had made friends with. He was a freelancer around the same time I was. All right, he had actually been out there for a bit, and we made buddies. And then he's like mentoring me and teaching me things. And so when he got hired as the music editor there is when I started writing there. And he gave me a lot of freedom to write about things. But he also taught me, one of the main things he taught me was like, you're going to write about stuff that everybody wants to read about, but you just have to do it in a different way. Like, I think Drake had maybe a new album come out or something like that. Drake was very big at the time and everybody was writing about Drake. So I was trying to figure out a way to write about Drake in a way that hadn't been done yet. And that's how that essay happened. I got the message from Molly Lambert, who was a staff writer at Grantland, and she lived in LA and she happened across the thing because it had spread around on Twitter a bit. And she sent me a message on Facebook. I have it saved on my phone still, like a screenshot of it, saying she liked the piece and she sent it to editors and, did I have any interest in pitching Grantland? And that's how that all happened. That was a very cool thing. I'll probably remember forever. I was sitting at my computer when it happened at my house, and my wife is running around in the background doing her stuff, and I saw it, and then I told her, and like neither one of us really knew what Grantland was, but we'd heard about it in the background, and there you go.
So you were a sports fan, a Spurs fan, and writing about sports, but maybe not as deep of a dive into the media world in terms of understanding things beyond just, you know, maybe ESPN.com or the major sites?
Yeah, exactly. There were sites that I read, like you mentioned the Spurs. There's a Spurs website called Pounding the Rock that I read all the time that I thought was really cool. Like that was sort of where I existed. Cause I don't live in New York or LA. So I'm outside of those media circles. And, you know, most of my friends are not in those groups. So it's just like, I just will pop in and turn my stuff in and pop out. So I had no idea how big of a place Grantland was until I wrote a thing there and it came out on Twitter. And then, you know, people freaked out a little bit. Like, I can't believe you landed a spot here. I've been pitching them forever, whatever. Yeah, it was crazy.
That's great. I love that. That kind of sort of, at every step, your sort of naivete actually allows you to maybe not feel overwhelmed by the opportunity or question whether or not you're ready for it. You just dive in. So you're there for a year, and then Grantland shutters, and you end up at The Ringer. There's so much loyalty from Bill Simmons to people from Grantland that he liked working with. Was there a fear when Grantland was going down that you would be in search of something else, or was it clear from, you know, pretty early on that you were going to make the jump to The Ringer?
No, I didn't know that the Ringer was going to be a thing. You know, I mean, you hear rumors that Bill's going to start a new whatever somewhere, but that's all, you know, I'm not in that circle even there. So I just thought I was going to just stay teaching, because the timing of it was really, really wild. So that my last year of teaching, this is like maybe around March or something, is when Bill got fired, or not fired, but they announced they weren't going to renew his contract. And like the 2 or 3 days before then is when I had agreed with Grantland to come work for them full time. I was going to leave teaching and I was going to go work there and be a full time writer. We worked all that stuff out, and then the Bill stuff happened, and I was like, oh, okay, well, whatever. This is like a side hustle anyway, so I'm just going to keep teaching and freelance, and I write for 100 different places. I'll figure it out. But then, I got, you know, a couple of people from Grantland buzzed me and they said, hey, we still want to do the contract. Grantland's still going to stick around. Come work for us full time for the year. I said, all right, I'll give it a try. You know, we had the pieces in place anyway. So I signed the contract in July of 2014 or something like that to go full time. I told my school I wasn't going to come back the next year. I told Grantland I would join them. I signed the contract full time. And then, you know, 3 months later, October is when they shut Grantland down. And I was like, oh, well, welcome to media, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, you know, you had your teaching job throughout all that whole stretch of entering the writing world and kind of putting your toe in the water. So when you gave up the teaching gig and you are now full-time media, was there a fear for you or your wife having three kids and understanding this sort of much more volatile nature of the media industry?
Yeah, we definitely knew about it. Laramie and I had talked a bunch about it before I made the decision. But because Grantland showed up with a guaranteed deal, it was like a 1-year contract. And also because I left my school on really good terms, I knew I could go back. They told me you can come back whenever. So I said, well, okay, if nothing else, we'll do a year and see what happens. And when ESPN shut Grantland down, ESPN was really cool about it. They said, hey, we can either let you out of your contract right now and you can go write elsewhere, or you can, you know, you can just have a seat and we'll pay you until your contract is over, which was 8 months later. I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to do that option. Let me just get these free checks. So then I just assumed, okay, well, I'll write out these 8 months. I'll get a little vacation and then I'll go back to teaching. But then the Rap Yearbook came out in the middle of October, which is right around all the time, right before all the Grantland stuff happened. So by like November, it was, it had done a bunch of stuff. It had been on the bestseller list. And I sort of felt around then that things were maybe changing a little bit for me.
Yeah, that's crazy. So you had done the Bun B's Rap Coloring and Activity book back in 2013, and you had done that with sort of collaboration from Bun B. And then 3 years later, your second book, the Rap Yearbook, which was a New York Times bestseller, now listed by Billboard as one of the 100 best music books of all time. how do you decide in your head that you're going to write a book? That's a big step for even a lot of writers, is the sort of scary idea of putting together a book. And your illustrator has become this huge part of your brand, almost. Like, those illustrations become associated with you because you use them for basketball and other things, your second book, and for your newsletters. And I think your current piece that you just are selling now, The Conference Room 5 Minutes, The Office, that is that the same illustrator as well?
Yeah, that's my homie, Arturo.
Yeah, so you guys are sort of like bound together by this. Let's go back to the Wrap Your Book. How did you come up with that idea, and did you have any idea it was going to blow up the way it did?
Nobody had any idea it was going to blow up like it did, which is why they gave me such a tiny amount of money to to write it, is my guess. The way that that idea came was, I had done the coloring book, as you mentioned, with a publisher named called Abrams. They do a bunch of art books, really cool. They're like a medium tier publisher. And this woman named Samantha Wiener, who was an editor there, saw this Tumblr I started about the rap coloring book, and she wanted to turn it into an actual book. So we worked that out, and I really liked working with her, and I knew I wanted to do another book. The coloring book did okay. It, you know, didn't, I mean, it sold maybe like 900 copies the first week, but it just kept selling. It's like a constant thing. So they said, all right, this was successful. Let's do another coloring book. I don't want to be the coloring book guy. So I was like, nah, I don't want to do that. We'll figure something else out. And Samantha actually had the idea for the Wrap Your Book. She hit me up one day and she said, hey, I got an idea for this thing. Are you going to write the most important song of every year from whenever to whenever? Each chapter is a different, about a different song. And when she pitched it to me, I was like, nah, that sounds super boring. Like, nobody's ever going to want to read it. I wouldn't read that. I really like that music, but I'm not going to read about Africa Bambaataa. Like, that's not fun. And then, you know, a little time passed and we had another kid, and Laramie was like, we should probably move or get a bigger place or something. They're like, all right, well, that idea sounds pretty good, Samantha. Let's do that, because they're going to give me a check for it.
Right.
And then, yeah, so we started working on it, and I knew it was going to be illustrated. Originally, I was supposed to do all the illustrations, and I just waited too long to get started. They give you like a year to write the book. I told myself I could do it in a couple months, and I realized I couldn't do it in a couple months, so I needed somebody to do the art. I found Arturo, and we did that.
But yeah, nobody knew it was going to do what it did. Was it always with Ice-T, or was that after it started selling well, they re-released it?
No. He was we did that early on because he was in the coloring book, and so I had gotten friendly with his manager. So I asked, you know, I wanted somebody who had some authority in the area,
right,
and he just made the most sense.
Do you have to get rights to all of those people to have illustrations of their image, or is it sort of public domain because they're public figures?
It depends on how you work it. With the coloring book, I needed permission. I had to get every person whose face is in there, I had to get them to sign a paper that said we can use them. I mean, there are a lot of coloring books nowadays that don't do that, and you can probably sneak and get away with it, but I was working with Bun B on it, and you know, we wanted to do everything the right way. So in the coloring book, yeah, we had to get everybody's permission. With the Wrap Your Book, you don't have to get somebody's permission if you're writing about them. So like if you have a chapter about Ice-T, you can draw a picture of Ice-T and put it in there. It's fine.
Got it.
If you use a photograph, you have to get permission from the photographer.
Right.
If you draw it, you get permission from the illustrator. So that's how that works.
And then they turned it into an AMC documentary. How did that turn out? Did you like how it ended up in documentary form?
They're filming that right now, actually.
Oh, so it's not out yet. Cool.
Yeah, it'll come out early next year. So they're working on it now. Maybe like, I'm guessing 20-30% of the way through it. But the people working on it are smart and good, so I'm sure it'll be good.
Yeah, Questlove and Black Thought, executive producing, right?
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's crazy, dude. That's awesome. So then you kind of spin that success into your latest book, which came out in October of last year, Basketball and Other Things, which only President Obama mentioned as one of his favorite books of the year. No big deal. No big deal. And I see you on Twitter continuing to sort of talk about that book and the sales of that book. You have a Basketball and Other Things newsletter that goes out for free. Tell me about how that book came about. What is it like, you know, what is it about basketball that you desperately needed to tell people in book form?
After the Rap Yearbook came out and did as well as it did, I knew we were going to have a chance to do another book, and I knew I was tired of writing about rap. So I just wanted, I was just looking for other things I could write about, and basketball was the first thing I thought of that I cared about, maybe more than I care about rap. So there you go. I pitched the idea to Samantha. It's the same editor again. I really enjoyed working with her on the Rap Yearbook, and she handled everything very smartly. So I pitched the idea to her. We came up with the template for it. I wanted it to feel sort of similar to the Rap Yearbook, but not the same. So I wanted each chapter to stand alone on its own, but they're sort of all connected by the central theme. And there you go. I pitched that book. And because the Rap Yearbook had done well, everything in the relationship between the publisher and me was different. Like, now they were just letting me do whatever I wanted to do. So we were able to get a little weirder with everything, and it turned out pretty okay.
Yeah, you are employed by Bill Simmons, who wrote the Book of Basketball.
Correct.
How did you, obviously basketball, there's many books about basketball. Was there any part of you that was like, how do I differentiate this, or how do I follow what he did and not make it the same, or step on his toes in any way?
Yeah, I thought about that a lot. So before I started writing the book, I ordered a whole bunch of basketball books to read through them. I wanted to make sure I wasn't going to do a thing that had already been done, or I was going to do it in a different way. And yeah, you can't try to keep up with somebody like Bill, who just knows more about basketball than anybody else knows, or as far as writers. Or you can't do a book like Jackie Mack, who was there, and she has all of the best stories, and she writes better than you do. Like, you can't compete with that level of person. So you've got to do a thing different, and then you don't have to worry about the other people. Nobody's ever like, oh, did you like Jackie Mack's book? You should read Shay's book, because they're totally different. what I'm saying?
When you've got a chapter called, If 1997 Karl Malone and a Bear Swapped Places for a Season, Who Would Be More Successful? Maybe you're not worried about stepping on Jackie Mack's toes. I don't think she had that in her book.
Yeah, she didn't have that in her book. She had actual good information and stories, but I wasn't doing that. So whatever, yeah. We'll be okay.
You'll be all right. So tell me about the newsletter. How'd you decide to do that, particularly for free? And then you start getting donations, and instead of taking them, you send them off to worthy causes.
The newsletter happened before the basketball book.
Oh, really? Okay. So it was sort of the germination of it.
Yeah, exactly. The Rap Yearbook had come out. Everything was going great. Grantland shut down. Everything's going bad. And I was just, as I mentioned, I had 8 months of doing nothing. And during that time, I was getting bored and I wanted to work. And I messaged Arturo and I was like, hey, let's do a thing. Like, we need to get in practice. Let's make a thing together. He said, all right, cool. So we came up with the idea for the newsletter. And we came up with the title Basketball and Other Things, because we were going to write about basketball, but also whatever we wanted, the opportunity to do other things if we felt like it. So we started doing the newsletter, and same as everything else, it started out as just a little thing to stay busy, and then it sort of took off, and before I knew it, we had 30-something thousand followers or subscribers to it. And we were doing it through this company called MailChimp. And with MailChimp, if you have under 250 subscribers or whatever, it's free to send the newsletter out. But once you go above that, you have to start paying money. And when we got 30,000 people, I think it was about maybe $250 a month. And I mentioned that on Twitter one day, I took a screenshot of the limits and showed how far we were past it and was making a joke. And then somebody said, oh, you should let me pay a piece of that. And then other people started saying, let me pay a piece of that. And we kept telling them no, because I was getting paid by ESPN anyway, so I don't need the money. I don't want, make me feel weird. But after maybe a month of everybody doing that, I told us, all right, I'm going to put a donation button in there, but we're just going to give the money away to a place. And he was he was with it. And I was paying him a tiny amount of money, not as much as he deserved, but he was I'm cool with that. Let's do it. We should give the money to this shelter in Dallas that it's called Genesis Woman Shelter, which is where Arturo spent a little bit of time living there. Had a bad situation going on with his father, and his mother left and took him and his brothers to live there. And so he was all for it, and we did it, and it turned out well. We didn't tell anybody ahead of time. We just posted screenshots saying, here's the money we got. Here's how much we sent to Genesis. that's what you get for trying to give us money, haha, as a joke. And then, it, you know, 4 weeks later, another month passed, and we decided we were going to do it again. And the second time, people were like, oh, where are you going to send the money this time? I was like, well, I guess we got to send the money to somewhere else now. So we just found another charity, and we just kept doing that. And same as all of the other stuff. It started out small, and then before you know it, we're raising tens of thousands of dollars, $100,000, and just sort of handing it out, and boom.
Hey, everybody, don't forget to go to ESPN and Apple Podcasts and subscribe to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain so you always have the latest episode. Don't forget to rate and review it as well and tell all your friends how awesome it is.
So you call your Twitter army the FOH army. Does that stand for what FOH usually stands for?
Yes, it does.
Okay. How did you come up with that name?
That wasn't me. That was somebody else on Twitter who, this was when the rap yearbook was coming out and we were making a bunch of noise and causing a bunch of trouble. And like, we sold out Amazon. We sold out a bookstore. We crashed some other bookstore's website. It was like this whole big thing. Somebody came up with that name because I think I had made a joke about somebody saying the book wasn't going to be successful. And now we're like, you know, FOH, get at it, whatever.
Yeah.
And then somebody
yeah.
grabbed it and turned it into that and just became its own thing.
So it's remarkable. Verge, The Verge called your Twitter army a utopia on Twitter, and Good Magazine called you their new favorite internet hero. And you are able to raise enormous amounts of money for a variety of things, whether it's someone who wants to go to a foreign country to teach English or somebody, as you mentioned, a battered women's shelter. How do you explain sort of being a teacher who becomes a writer who is just in the last, you know, couple years become this major, public profile, being able to harness all of that and influence people the way you do?
I would guess it just has something to do with being honest, or as honest as I can be on the internet. I don't think too much about it. I just assume it's not going to happen anymore, and then every day it happens again. So I don't know. You'd probably have to ask people who follow along or who send money and why they choose to do it.
Yeah. What do you think your approach to Twitter is, if you had to try to crystallize it into a couple sentences?
I'm just trying to have some fun on the internet with some of my friends.
Do you have a lot of trolls or people who are trying to bring down the positivity of the whole endeavor?
Every once in a while they'll pop up. It's a rare occurrence. I would say like 95% of the time it's nice and friendly. 5% it's not. Mostly that comes from whenever I tweet like political stuff, then right. The other side jumps in. You know, they're not excited about that. If I'm like, oh,
money,
I'm pro-choice.
Planned Parenthood and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other side, I can't believe you would do that. I'm like, well, get out of here. I don't care. Or like, I don't like Donald Trump because it's the stuff that he does. And I mentioned that very aggressively. And then the other side comes, you know, that's when right. It happens. For the most part, everybody's chill.
Do you find that for the most part, you tend to avoid hot button issues because your natural interests are music and basketball and less about, you know, maybe social issues? And so that allows people to be interacting with you about things that maybe don't inspire as much venom?
No, you know what it is? Because I try to be as outspoken as I can be about that sort of stuff, like the immigration stuff that's happening. I try to mention it and be very clear about where I am in this argument, or be very clear about where I am in a pro-choice argument, or be very clear about where I am in a Donald Trump argument. And it's just like, okay, people who are similar, of similar opinions will be like, all right, I'm with this guy. And people who aren't are like, you know what, I'm not with this guy, I'm out of here. And that happens every time. And then after a while, it's just like, you know, it's the same way you make friends in real life. Like, you talk about stuff, and if other people like the same stuff you talk about, then you sort of hang out, and there
right.
you go.
I'm trying to learn from you. It seems so simple when you say that. I don't know if maybe, I don't know what's causing my Twitter to certainly not be a utopia.
Well, I can think of one big difference.
Yeah, well, like, that's, yeah. Yeah, that's the obvious one.
It's a whole different world out there for women on the internet, which is crazy.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to keep following your lead. Like I said, I'm no longer Serrano adjacent. I'm all in on the FOH army. So I got to take notes is what I need to do.
So yeah, we're buddies now.
I just had Mike Schur on my podcast, and he was the best, and I could have talked to him for hours and hours, and I want to be best friends, but I'm really, you know, casually moving in so that I don't scare him away. But I read that you have a sitcom in production with him.
Yeah, we were working on a thing for a while. TV is a weird place. You have to be in L.A. if you really want to do it, and I don't want to be in L.A. I think that's the TV story. That's like the shorthand version. But yeah, we're not working on that anymore.
Man.
So Mike was great. Mike was like just awesome. I met him. This is what's crazy about Mike is I had no idea how like important of a person he was in that world. Cause I was new to TV and I was just around in LA taking meetings and him and I started hanging out and he never mentions anything about like, he never even implies how powerful he is in that space. You'll never hear him say anything about that. But if you walk into a room and Mike Schur is on your team, everybody just pays attention and they're like, here's some money, make a thing. Like that's just what happens when Mike is involved.
He's the ESPN of the TV world. It's right. The four letters get you a lot of places. So does Mike Schur's name.
He just makes things happen. So I went out there and I'm like, hey, Mike, I came up with this idea. My wife and I had this idea for a TV show. And I mentioned it to him and we met for like an hour. We talked about TV stuff for like 5 minutes. And then the rest of the time we talked about our kids and sports and music or whatever. And then he's like, yeah, let's do a thing together. And we started working on it and we pitched it to ABC and they bought a script and we did it all, you know, all that whole thing. But it was a very positive experience. ABC was great. Mike was great. It's cool. I very highly recommend working with Mike Schur on a television thing if you can.
I mean, yeah, I would love to. But unlike you, I don't have, like, giant onions where you're just like, hey, I just called up Mike Schur. And I was like, hey, I just called the LA Weekly. And I was like, I'm a writer. Here you go. I just wrote a book. And now it's New York. I got to work on that. I got to work on that. You're walking in with crazy onions. Does your connection to Mike Schur have anything to do with your new ScrantonProject.com?
Oh, no. That we just did that on the side. This was like just a testament to the show. Arturo and I really like The Office. We watch it all the time. And you know, I wanted to write about it, but I didn't want to do a whole book and I didn't want to do a newsletter and I just wanted to try something new. So we put together, it's basically a bundle of essays that you read on your phone or Kindle or whatever. But no, Mike was not attached to it or anything like that.
As you're talking about all this stuff, I'm basically just making a list in my head of all of the Shea Serrano items I have to purchase, which is not usually how this podcasts go. I don't usually end up just immediately giving money to the person I've spoken with. But I'm taking all this stuff. I want to talk quickly before we have to get out of here about the WNBA, because you wrote basketball and other things, and there was this very sort of organic, open-hearted way that you were sort of told there might be a blind spot in the book. And instead of reacting in defense, you sort of were like, yeah, good point. Let me look into that. So can you tell the story of that?
Yeah, that's my homie, Natalie, from Bleacher Report. Do you know Natalie?
I follow her now because of that. But I didn't know her before. She seems pretty bad.
Yeah, she's really great. So the book came out, and the book is an NBA book. Like, you open it, you read it. It's like, this is a dedication to the NBA. So like a love letter to the NBA, but it's titled Basketball and Other Things. It's not titled NBA and Other Things. So when it came out, she saw the book and she's like, oh, you know, I'll check this out. And she like control left or whatever you do in there to see what, you know, is Diana Taurasi mentioned in here? Is Lisa Leslie mentioned in here? Like whatever. And it wasn't. And she mentioned it. And I was like, you know, of course at the beginning I was defensive because I'm like, this is not that, this is a different thing or whatever. Like I'm in my feelings about it. But I think I was like late at night or maybe early one morning. And a few hours later I was thinking on it again. And I was like, hey, like, is this a blind spot for me? Why is there not that in here? So I said, you know what, let me reach out to her and see that, let her know I saw her thing. And like, I thought about it and she was right. And so I did that to her, messaged her and she was cool about everything. And I was like, hey, I hope nobody said anything mean to you about this, because my people can be a little aggressive sometimes. And, you know, like ever since then, she just became a buddy. And so I was like, let me message my other homie, Kristen Ledlow, and ask her, like, who do I need to be following in the WNBA space because I want to know about this world? And she mentioned a few people, started following them, started paying attention. And then the tournament came around. And right at the beginning of the tournament, there's a player who plays for or used to play for Oregon named Ina Ayuso, this point guard. She's like a freshman backup point guard or something. She did some crazy move. Her defender fell down. It was this great clip. And I saw it, and it made me very happy. And I made a joke about it on Twitter. And right before the tournament started or in the first game of the tournament, she did it again to another defender. And I was like, okay, Oregon is my team because this is my favorite player in the world now. And it just started like that, and I started trying to pay attention and watch it, and I got really into the tournament. And, you know, Oregon made it far in the tournament, and then they got destroyed by Notre Dame. And then during the Notre Dame game, I started watching Jessica Shepherd and Marina Mabry, and I was like, okay, I'm in on Notre Dame now. And then, you know, they, of course, had a great game against UConn in the championship game, and you've got Arike doing all – just hitting game winner after game winner. And it just kept growing and growing and growing, and – I was like, I don't know, paying attention one day or not paying attention rather. And they showed a commercial for the WNBA draft. And there was a player on Oregon, Lexi Bando, who was a senior. And I knew she was going to try and get in the league. So I watched the draft to see if she got drafted. And she didn't. And it sort of hurt my feelings. But then I found out that she got like a tryout with the Sparks. So then I just started paying attention to the WNBA that way. And yeah, just sort of grew and grew and grew. And the more you pay attention, the more you learn about the players. And that's really what draws you in, is like in anything, if it's a TV show or if it's a sport or whatever, you watch it and you learn about a story of somebody and you go like, all right, this is cool. Yeah. I'm in there. And that's just what's happened with WNBA. And so now I'm like an Aces fan and I've got my favorite players and I got to go to a game and it's been a lot of fun to like, you just automatically double your basketball intake, which is, you know, basketball is the best sport. You should have as much of it as possible.
Yeah, if you're a hoops fan. Yeah, and we talk about that a lot, obviously, at ESPNW and anybody else who's sort of about forwarding the cause of women's sports is it's about eyeballs. You can't know that you love Kayla McBride or Asia Wilson unless you know that they exist, and then you get told about them and you give it an opportunity to know their team and their stories and the rivalries and everything else. You did an interview with the Las Vegas Review Journal about Asia Wilson, and you talked about how she moves, and there's just certain players that move differently. And it reminded me of when I got into watching Elena Deladon, and I was like, she's basically like
Dirk. Oh, the Della Devil.
Yeah.
She's like, crazy.
I'm 6 feet, and I used to like to shoot the three sometimes, even though I was a center. So my favorite players have often been like the Kevin Garnetts, like, right? The center, the big guys who can play point and shoot the ball and move, you know, and Deladon reminds me of Dirk in so many ways. And that was the same way I saw her at first. I was like, man, she just moves differently. She just moves in a way that she's just so dominant. And it was cool to hear you like kind of have that revelation with Asia Wilson. And tell us why you became a fan of the Aces. Why Vegas?
Well, they were in San Antonio beforehand, and then they moved to Las Vegas. So I was like, well, there's one check. Also, they're a new franchise. I'm new to the WNBA. There's another check. They've drafted a superstar in Asia who I remembered from the tournament. So I was like, oh, well, there's another check. Like, this is a team that I can grow with. They're a new team, new player. Let me be a part of this one. And I just started watching them. And the analogy I always make is when you start watching a new thing, it's like if you watch a new TV show, you don't know anything about anybody in the beginning, but the stars of the show themselves pretty quickly. And that's what brings you in. Like if you watch Billions, very quickly you're like, oh, Chuck Rhodes is the guy. Bobby Axelrod is the guy.
Yeah.
Wendy, you know, like you pick up who the main ones are. And that they bring you in, and then you learn about the other parts, and that's what happened with the Aces and then with everybody else. Like with the Aces, for example, I started watching Asia, who, as you mentioned, is very clearly a superstar and just is in that class of superstar. And so I'm paying attention to her, and then I see Kayla McBride going nuts, and I'm like, all right, cool, Kayla's cool. And then I see Kelsey Plum and Mariah Jefferson just flying around on the perimeter. And I'm like, all right, they're cool. And then like it's like every game, a new player. Oh, Carolyn Swords, like she came in and did a great thing. Park is out there. Like you just pick up these other players and then you Google and read about their history. And then it just becomes interesting. Like Kayla McBride went to Notre Dame, which is cool. Like I have that connection already. It just all fits together.
You're so enthusiastic about it, and it comes from a place that makes sense to anybody who likes hoops, right? You just get more hoops, and you get awesome games and stars. Do you get crap on Twitter for you know, being a fan of the WNBA? Because it's such an oft-ridiculed league by those who don't ever actually watch it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But it's usually people who are, like, who are new to the stuff I'm doing on Twitter, or, like, if I make a joke, I'm watching a game, and the Mercury played the Aces the other day, and it looked like the Aces were going to win easily, and then Diana Taurasi went nuts. And I started making jokes about, like, I'm going to call the police on Diana Taurasi. If she scores again, I'm going to go riot through downtown Phoenix. Like, she was killing us, and it was hurting my feelings. So I was, you know, tweeting about the game, and then those tweets get spread out into the universe. And then it's usually somebody who's, like, is not in our lane, and it got enough retweets that it ended up somewhere else. And they'll respond, you know, there's definitely that, but I think that happens with anything. It definitely is more aggressive when it comes to, like, the WNBA or college basketball or whatever. It's like, it's crazy that you can always count on it happening.
Right. But it makes people so angry. You're like, why are you doing
that? It really does.
Like, you like basketball, like, so do they. You'd want probably your wife or daughter or someone that you love to be a bad pro basketball player. So where's the disconnect? Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I just, you know, let me like what I like. And if you don't like it, then leave me alone. It's cool. Asia and Kayla have become like my unofficial. I don't have daughters. I wish I did. I grew up in a family of girls. I've got three younger sisters, you know. So that's what, when we had kids, I was like, let me just get one daughter because I know that space. And it didn't come. But Asia and Kayla, I'm taking them in. Those are my two.
I love it. And I love that your approach to it is very much just like anything else. You know, you treat them with the same sense of humor and respect. I mean, that's something that women's sports needs a lot of too. There's so much defense of it, which is necessary because of how people view it, but it also ends up taking away from the storylines and the intrigue and the interest that goes beyond just, we don't want to be cheerleaders. We want to be commentators. And that can sometimes be this hard line to find in women's sports. All right, before I let you go, you have to do the one thing that everybody does, but nobody expects.
Didn't expect to call the Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
That's right, the 10 questions everybody has to answer. Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
I wish I could sing.
Mm-hmm. That's what everybody says. Number two, what's your desert island album? You can only have one.
It's Dark and Hell is Hot by DMX, 1998.
I'm amazed that you know that as a music person, because that's usually the most infuriating question for people, but you had your answer, which is really impressive.
Oh, yeah.
Number three, if you could switch lives with someone for a day, who would it be?
Diana Taurasi. But only on the night when she's hot. Give me a night when she's cold from three. Give me when she hit like seven threes in a row the other night.
Yeah, maybe not right now because she's suspended, so you don't want that day.
Yeah, I know she. I got to talk to her for a few minutes, and that was the first thing I asked her about was why she was cussing everybody out. And I was keeping track of the technicals, and she got that other one. I was like, well, I'll see you next game, I guess.
Yeah, there you go. Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
And I was watching the movie Signs, and there's a scene when an alien cuts across the alley. You finally get to see him. And that was the first time in my life I screamed in a movie theater.
Number five, what's the most embarrassed you've ever been?
The most embarrassed I ever been was... Oh, I don't think I can tell that story. It's an inappropriate story, and you're on ESPN.
Can you use euphemisms or no?
No, I can't.
No, okay.
I'm gonna dodge now.
Anything else you could submit as also embarrassing, but perhaps appropriate?
Also embarrassing is, you know what? I'll tell you, this is an easy one. But one time I'd been flying around all over the place. I think it was like maybe the book tour or something. And I got back at Houston, and my car had been towed or was gone from where I parked it. And I was yelling at everybody and throwing a big fit. And it turned out that I was in the wrong garage. that was bad.
My friend was on Top Chef, and they do such a surprise, like, all right, you're on, that his car was parked on the street, and he literally came back months later, and he had to pay, like, thousands of dollars to get it out of the lot because it had been months. He was like, what the hell? Number six, what would you consider your biggest failure?
My biggest failure is that I did not become starting point guard. for the Spurs.
So nothing you've actually tried at have you failed? Just the thing that was almost physically impossible?
Oh, no, I tried at that. No, it's not physically impossible. Earl Boykins was in the NBA. Muggsy Bogues was in the NBA. Nate Robinson was in the NBA. Spud Webb was in the NBA. I could have been in the NBA. I'm just not good enough.
That's true. You're a tremendous failure. I apologize for giving you a break. Number seven, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
A willingness to just get kicked in the teeth, keep walking forward.
Yeah, it sure seems like it, man. I got to get some of your ballsiness. You are really unfuckwithable. That's my phrase.
I think can cuss?
They're going to bleep it out. So I try not to give them too much work. I started out, I did one with Jamel to start it out, and we were talking about a baby shower for lesbians in a strip club she was at, and it was just F this, F that, and at the end they're like, well, you can't swear. I mean, we're still to bleep it. I'm like, ah. Oh. I was sold a fake bill of goods. Number eight, have you ever been in a fist fight?
Yeah, I've been in several fist fights.
Are you usually the victor?
I'm probably like 4-4 in my eight fist fights.
Eight fist fights? Why so many?
I don't know. Maybe it's just a Mexican thing. You just fight. Like, that's just what you do. Most of them have been basketball related, so
I
can say that at least.
Did you ever call the cops after someone set a hard screener?
I've never called the cops on anybody in my life, but I would like to one day.
Glad to hear it. Number nine, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
I wish I had muscles. I saw a picture of myself recently, and that was the main thing. That was the first thing I thought.
So you got to hit the weights. Are you going to hit the weights or no?
I will die with zero muscle mass.
That also may have contributed to the San Antonio Spurs thing. That might have been
part of
the problem.
That could be a part of it, yeah.
Starting to put things together here. Number 10, what three words would you most hope that people would use to describe you?
I'm going to go with the Grinch. Stink, stank, stunk. I'm going to just pick those three words because I think that's funny.
But you're not a Grinch at all.
I'm not a Grinch at all. Those are the first three things I bought. No, if I had to pick three words that I wanted people to say about me, I would say tall, muscular, good at singing. That's five words, but I'm going to go with that.
Words, and none of them are true. So at least you've got dreams.
Yeah.
And finally, the bonus, who would you recommend that I have on this podcast?
I would recommend that you speak with Manu Ginobili.
Okay.
I would really like that. I would like y'all's two energy in the same space would be cool, I think.
I would love to find out if I have a good energy with Manu Ginobili. That sounds promising. Hey, Shay, thanks so much. This was fun.
I appreciate your satisfying.
Oh, and another thing.
This week's That's What She Read is a piece that my husband originally shared on Facebook, and it took me a couple days to click and read. The headline is Veterans Speak Out Against the Militarization of Sports on WBUR.org. And I shared it on Twitter after reading it and on Facebook and thought it was so powerful. It's by Howard Bryant, who's also sometimes an ESPN contributor. And I was really amazed at the response, the number of people who shared and felt as moved as I did by the story. And I think it's a conversation that needs to be had more. And it's basically about how our post-9/11 sports have sort of taken on this paid patriotism in the form of giant flags and flyovers and camouflage gear that's sold in accordance with military holidays. And the perils of feeling as though these moments of honoring our troops are not done from a place of true respect or even done with an understanding of what these veterans or current active military members would want, but more so in part because teams and leagues are getting paid by the National Guard or by their state's National Guard or by a larger military groups to make money using what was meant to be a healing gesture after 9/11 and later on believed to be done out of respect and out of a gesture of thanks for our veterans, and to find out that so many of the moments throughout our sporting events were not, in fact, inspired by a real respect, but rather money I guess shouldn't be surprising to most of us, but is upsetting. And there's a great segment in the story about Nick Francona, whose father, Terry, played in the majors and obviously was the manager for the World Series winning Red Sox in 04. He was working for the Mets, and a lot of the things he tried to do were to connect the team to veterans in meaningful ways. And he kept coming up against problems, including getting fired for work that he tried to do connecting players with Gold Star families. I really recommend you read the story. Again, it's on WBUR.org. Veterans Speak Out Against the Militarization of Sports by Howard Bryant. And just maybe step back and try to understand how we have been force-fed a certain narrative about what the connection between the anthem and sports is, what the connection between the military and sports is, and whether or not this patriotism is real or whether it's disingenuous and inauthentic and American tax dollars going to the sort of forced patriotism that in any other country we would find upsetting and as a sign of bad things to come. I recommend reading it. And thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.